Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host, producer, and sports writer for the LSJ. Joining me, as always, two men who just picked up a $500 monthly stipend from a lending giant. It's Detroit Free Press beat writer Chris Solari and LSJ sports columnist Graham Couch. Chris, let's start with you. What is college-age Solari doing with that sweet, sweet $500 a month?
Well, let's be clear here that if we aren't getting paid in realistic dollars, if it's only theoretical dollars, there will be no free advertising on this podcast. So my theoretical dollars that we're going to use, I'm going to put right into the bank and grow a theoretical nest egg for this trip to Miami in a couple of weeks that can bloom into many, many things.
No, I asked, what is college age Chris doing with this hypothetical money?
College age Chris?
Yeah. Oh,
he's at one of the local establishments that are still around East Lansing. Again, they got a lot of that money anyway, so I'm not going to give any free publicity, but a few of those places will probably still get some of that money in current day.
Yes, so. Of course. What about you, Graham?
I don't even want to say it. That would be, put it this way. My parents gave me a $1,500 loan when I was a senior in college living on the north side of Chicago so I could do an unpaid internship. I know, white privilege. But the idea was I had made $1,500 over the course of a semester at the student newspaper the year before. But the thing is, they gave me that like $100 a week, and that I could budget. When I was given $1,500 all at once, it lasted like 2 days. And of course, then I had to, work for a couple off the book mobsters selling electronics on the north side of Chicago that semester. My free time to.
So basically, you'd be gambling just like you'd be gambling now with that money.
It did not help that the Lions went 2-14 that year. It did not help. I'll be honest.
I will say, There is a long defunct business in East Lansing that probably would have got a good chunk of that money called InFlight, that at one point sold many things that were not necessarily, they were accoutrements, but they also sold bootleg CDs. So that's where I would have spent it, not on the accoutrements, but for the CDs, the bootleg CDs. People who don't know.
That was going to be my non-alcoholic beverage answer was CDs, because you know, high school, college, is basically what I did whenever I got paid. I'd go to the local CD shop and buy music that I would not listen to now and haven't listened to for a number of years. So it's kind of,
I've got like 1,500 CDs sitting to my back left right now.
So. I got rid of my CDs a long, long time ago. So. Yeah,
should have let me know. All right. Well, yeah, we need to talk some Michigan State, huh?
All right. Well, no more time for nostalgia. Let's talk a little. Michigan State football. It's been a few. We've had like 4 or 5 days to kind of think about and reflect or rewatch the big win over Northwestern. And obviously, I think the thing people are still talking about 5 days later is Kenneth Walker's incredible, incredible performance. Boy, when he gets that first carry, 75-yard touchdown, that really set the springs for quite the game. This football team has a buzz about them that we probably have not seen since the end of 2017, for that bowl game win.
Yeah, I'd say that it's still up in the air whether it's a buzz versus curiosity. You know what I mean? I think a lot of people that know what Northwestern was know how much they lost, and it makes them a little bit different than a year ago. But it is still a Big Ten game. And it is still Pat Fitzgerald, and you know that Northwestern always plays Michigan State tough. And Michigan State blew the doors off of them on both sides of the ball. And Kenneth Walker showed burst that I can't remember seeing running. I mean, you know, Jeremy Langford was good, and he had some good wheels, but I don't remember this kind of – he took a while to get going downhill. Walker's got – wiggle to him. He's got vision. He's got burst to the edge and speed to get past it. I mean, you know, and I think that the passing game is going to come along because, you know, I think Thorne built a relationship with some of those guys. Particularly, I mean, he's got a long-standing relationship with Jaden Reed, which I've always thought would be one of the determining factors in the quarterback position eventually, is that you know, they've got a rapport built. And, you know, you saw him go to Naylor. You saw him go to Trey Mosley, who I thought had another a good game as well. So I think they're really deep there. But, you know, defensively, there's some kinks to work out. But particularly at linebacker and on the edge where they got the transfers. But all in all, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better start to the season than Walker's touchdown run, plus with how well the line blocked that play. And you couldn't ask for a better start to the season with that game, with a road win at Northwestern, late night, and going into this week against Youngstown State.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was how it happened, as Chris alluded to, obviously the run and just sort of right out of the gate punching somebody in the mouth. It was the physical nature in which it happened. It was how organized they looked too. You know, they looked like a team that was, you know, was with it. And I think you sort of judge Mel Tucker early in his tenure, and you know there are going to be gaps in talent from time to time, and we'll see what happens with the roster over years and stuff like that. And he's obviously turned it over pretty quickly and impressively. The other thing that I thought was important was sort of the resolve the defense showed, which you don't know what a defense is going to be because it's hard to tell what Northwestern is, and they may be an offense that struggles. But they got beat a couple times deep early, and then I think it was you know, six or seven possessions before they gave up a second first down after that big play. And so it wasn't like the wheels came off right then, right? It was, all right, that's enough. So I think that's a positive trait too. Now, what that looks like when they get hit with an offense that's got a little more juice, we'll find out in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the defensive side of the ball, particularly the pass. I mean, you know, it wasn't just the deep stuff. It was the stuff over the middle too. And I think that's where you saw Quaveris Crouch. He had talked about he's still learning the roles and responsibilities of the linebacker spot in the 4-2-5 in the weeks coming into the season. And I think he saw that on a couple of those over the middle touchdown pass, particularly the first one to Pugh. And then, you know, the coverage on the edge with Ronald Williams. I think he gave up the big passes, and I think Kalen Gervin gave up a big pass as well. But Williams also gave up a third down slant where he got beat to the inside. That's a play you got to make. And, you know, he got beat to the edge and the outside on that other touchdown pass, a little out that, you know, that again, you're talking about two guys that a year, not even a year ago, were playing in another system. And, you know, they're trying to learn and feel their way through that. And I think that, you know, there's a reason that they're out there. I mean, you can see the physical talent. It wasn't that they didn't make plays. I mean, Crouch had a good game tackle-wise. I think he ended up with seven tackles. And, you know, I think he had a sack as well. So you're gonna see those guys blossom. I mean, but, you know, those are some of the kinks. I mean, I think Mel Tucker was really realistic in his approach post-game, and then particularly on Tuesday when he kind of recapped everything. You knew that, you know, this guy combed over and poured over all the film and realized we're still nowhere near a finished product. And I think that's more than just a message to his team. I think that's a reality too.
Chris, I am glad you said that about Crouch, because I kind of thought he played a little slow in the game as well, but all I saw on Twitter was a lot of plaudits and celebration for him. So you stole my point, Chris, is what I was.
Yeah, the touchdown over the middle in particular. I mean, you could see, you know, and that's him and Halliday, and I think Darius Snow was in at the nickel on that, and it kind of tight end got in between them a little bit, and responsibilities weren't there, knowing who had him. And just enough of a window for Hunter Johnson to fit the ball in there. So there, I mean, that's a scoring play. You know, I mean, there's things like Jarrett Horst's 15-yard penalty after the whistle. You know, that was that ultimately didn't cost them, but it comes on the heels, you know, right after you know, Trey Mosley makes this one-handed catch on the sideline diving. Give you a 26-yard gain. Well, now you back it up 15 yards. I mean, those are the kind of things that can't happen. Jaden Reed's penalty. I get Jaden Reed's penalty. I get it. I saw it back. He went and he slapped high fives with someone in the stands. You can't touch people in the stands. That's a big no-no, and you're going to get flagged on that every time. But I get the reality of it. This is 8 months of pent-up emotion and, you know, 16 months of not having fans in the stands or however long it's been. And, you know, you're in your hometown and you come back and, you know, first play, your team scores a touchdown. But still, I mean, that's, you know, Jaden Reed's got to learn from that. But you got to cut out those foolish penalties, right? I mean, that cost you 15 yards on a kickoff and gave Northwestern great field position on the second drive after you have this monumental emotional lift on the first play. So those are things that, you know, sometimes it's just the nature of football, but also, you know, this is where Mel Tucker talks about neutral thinking, and you gotta be able to compartmentalize some of those things so you're not getting penalties after the whistle.
Yeah, and going back to Crouch, it was interesting watching him because he moves fast sometimes, but he's sometimes in the wrong place. But he gets wherever he's going quickly. But sometimes you can see him thinking out there. Like, he's going to be an interesting guy to watch because he does have unbelievable athletic talent. You see it sometimes. He just looks like a dude, and he's intimidating, and he can make up for mistakes. You know, but part of defense and successful defenses is trusting each other. And it'll be interesting to see when they face an offense that can really stress them, and you need to be in the right places. If you know, and guys need to be able to trust that the right guy's going to be in the right gap and the right guy's going to be doing the right assignment. Like that stuff, he's going to have to get up to speed quick, you know, fast enough for that to help the rest of the defense.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting that we're here kind of nitpicking a lot of things here in a game that they won pretty comfortably. I mean, we've already reached the point where I believe I saw my first Kenneth Walker Heisman talk post a couple days ago on the Twitter machine. So that always kind of brings a chuckle to me.
Hey, it's understandable. You know what? The guy's leading the nation in rushing yards, and he had big plays. I mean, that what puts you in the Heisman talk, those kind of things. I mean, that said, it's one game in September, but it was a conference game. So, you know, I get it. I get the fan reaction to it, but, you know, you got to be able to do that over a couple games. I think the Miami game is going to be the real telltale one. If Walker can have a big game in that, Michigan State can have a big game in that, now you're going to start seeing a lot of conversation change about Michigan State. This week against Youngstown State, it should be anticipated.
And to be fair to MSU fans, there was nothing else they could do. I mean, this was the opponent in front of them. I was a Big Ten opponent who had won the West and obviously had lost a lot of pieces, but has over the years provided a pretty decent baseline for somebody you can measure against. And they were flat out better, more physical, more talented. And that was, I think, something. I mean, there have been a lot of times in recent years, and yours truly has been occasionally part of misconstruing what Michigan State football would be going into a season, where people had hopes and they did not meet them. And so I think to have them meet them and probably exceed them for week one was a really sort of just relief for a lot of people.
Yeah, and Walker won the Maxwell National Player of the Week award and did not win the Walter Camp Award, which was a little bit of a chagrin to some people on MSU Twitter. But I also, regarding the running backs and the yards and everything, I do find it interesting that within the past 24 hours, both of you guys have separately written stories regarding MSU's offensive line, and they were great last week against Northwestern in a game they really needed to be.
Yeah, and deep. You know, we knew they would have depth, but, you know, depth versus productive depth is a whole other thing. I mean, we've seen that the last 2 years with this offensive line that's had a lot of guys back, had a lot of guys banged up as well. But, you know, you think about how good they played at the point of attack. I mean, like, you go to that first play with Jarrett Horst. You know, he drives, he and JD Duplain on the left side drive their men about 3 yards to the right to open that hole for Kenneth Walker to burst. And then the second touchdown, same thing. I mean, those guys on the left side, I mean, they were running over that left side quite a bit. And then, you know, I think Graham, you were writing about Luke Campbell. I mean, Luke Campbell came in and it didn't seem like there was much of a drop off in that first half. You know, he's a guy that's been hurt a lot for the last, he missed last year with injury. He had, you know, off and on injuries throughout his career. You know, he's a 6-year guy, but I mean, he's a grown man playing against young kids on that Northwestern defense and doing what he was supposed to do.
Yeah. And I just posted a column on him. It was interesting because even up to the second week of camp, he didn't know this was going to happen. And he told his dad on Wednesday that he was going to travel. Like, his dad was at a wedding in Columbus because they didn't, you know, he was officiating it, so he had to be there. But they did not expect this debut for him. And what's so significant about him, I think, is that what we talked about last week was the idea that the place they did not have depth was at tackle. Like, they could, you know, the interior, you know, and you're still right on the depth. It always reminds me of the old Heathcote line about there's good news and bad news. The good news is we have everybody back. The bad news is we have everybody back. And that's kind of the way it's been with the offensive line. But when you get a guy like Campbell, if he's able to stay healthy and be used, and he was used on both sides of the line, and right and left tackle, that does give you the ability to spell those guys. Now, whether he could, if you had an injury to Horst or something, I still think you'd feel it massively, whether, you know, he could come in and play, you know, a full game or, you know, I don't know. But it's been so long, and there have been moments in the last 5 years. I don't want to say there haven't been. There was a game against Minnesota in 2017 and not a very good Minnesota team where they kind of pushed him around. And so they've done it once in a while against not great teams. So we'll still have to see a little bit, but you know, a really promising start and what's a veteran offensive line that right now is pretty healthy.
Not to this extent though. You know what I mean? I mean, 326 yards on the ground. I mean, it had been since 2014 with Jeremy Langford that they did that.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's pretty, I mean, that was Jack Conklin's line, you know, back then.
Even that team in 2017, which actually had Campbell and Cole Chewins when they were both kind of young, promising tackles before.
The common thread is there was an Allen somewhere in that mess.
Yes. But in that 2017 group, I mean, they were able to, almost all of that work, if I recall that game, was done on the outsides. They weren't able to run off tackle this way on the left side and through the, I mean, and that was with LJ Scott, and it wasn't like this. This looked different. This was a physical punch that they delivered that we really haven't seen them do against a Big Ten opponent.
You know, and it mentioned Matt Allen. I think Matt Allen played a really good game at center, and then Nick Samak came in and had some struggles early, but then threw a pretty good key block on the downfield screen to Jordan Simmons for the touchdown. But I want to talk a little bit about the last Kenneth Walker touchdown in the fourth quarter, because to me, that was one of those things where now you're going into your two, three deep, and you've got Matt Carrick, who's got starting experience. You've got Blake Buter, who's got starting experience, and a couple young guys that they like on the edge with Spencer Brown and Dan Van Opstel, and Samak was at center. I mean, that's a pretty good group back there that, I mean, they were able to really get a touchdown to salt that game away late, and did so by creating a hole up the middle for Walker to kind of run through contact. So, I mean, you know, that there maybe there's a little more depth than even Chris Kapilovich thought. I mean, he thinks they can go about eight deep. You know, maybe there's a little more depth there once the season progresses.
I think the upset of the podcast so far is that it was Graham Couch with the first Cole Chewins reference, and it was not Solari.
That's solid, man. That's solid.
Well, we have been recording for 21 minutes and not one mention of the quarterbacks at all, which is a topic that we spent a lot of time talking about in the preseason, obviously. And of course, as you guys know, as everybody knows by now, Peyton Thorne is the guy who got the start, and I thought looked pretty good. Although, you know, Kenneth Walker obviously kind of stole the spotlight on Friday night, but you know, Peyton Thorne had his moments for sure, Graham.
Let's not make that his nickname there.
Yeah.
The abbreviated nickname.
I hope it sticks.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chris and I had last week, we both sort of had inklings that it was Thorne. Nobody quite with, you know, somebody direct to be able to report it, but it was pretty evident that it was going to be him. So I don't think that was a huge surprise. And the more I talked to an NFL scout in the press box who was not as high on Russo and sort of explain, you know, he was not surprised that he went with Peyton Thorne. And he was, even his only other game he had seen Thorne, to be honest, was the Ohio State game at Spartan Stadium the year before. So in which Thorne, you know, was okay, but struggled at times, and that was a blowout. But Thorne's performance, I think, you know, he did part of why he won the job. It was a you know, big mistake free. I mean, obviously there are mistakes that happen within the game that, that you can notice and some we don't see, but the costly mistake, he didn't make it. He didn't, they had the winning formula and he didn't screw that up. And he made a few really nice throws as well. And showed some patience and did some things with his legs. And the question, I think that will come for him. And he, you know, he should have time to develop into the role. I mean, you think Connor Cook is a redshirt sophomore, was not even starting at this point and struggled for a while more. I mean, he's a young player, but will he be able to, when that run game is taken away by somebody or when they're struggling there, will he be able to carry drives with those receivers instead of just have a supplemental throw here or there that's key at a good time or whatever? And that's the thing we don't know yet.
I think there were a couple things that I saw in his game that I really liked. One was the ability to run, and we knew that was there. We saw that last year, and I think he had that one real big gain in this where he kind of bounced to the outside and picked up a first down and got that late hit out of bounds. So when it was an 18-yard gain, ended up being a 33-yard gain. With that, I mean, it was a big play early in the game. So I think that's one thing. I saw him also stretch the pocket. There was the pass he had to Connor Hayward where it was, you know, they had a pressure from the backside. He sensed it and starts rolling to his right. He and Connor Hayward lock eyes. They understand the situation and they're rolling together. Almost step by step, about 10 yards downfield from each other. And while Thorne is watching Hayward, he also sees the pass rush coming up, sidesteps, steps up and around. I mean, that was a veteran move right there. And he completes the pass on the sideline to Hayward for I think a first down or made it a short and manageable situation. So, you know, that was a veteran kind of play from a guy who'd only started the one game. And I think the other thing, he was a very good game manager in this. He didn't have to do what he did at Penn State and put the offense on his back and throw for 300-plus yards and 40, 50 times in the game. And if you're able to keep him in that role, like you said, if you keep that run game going, and he's a part of that, you know, he's really good in those short and intermediate routes to keep the sticks moving. And, you know, there's work to be done downfield. He missed some deep shots, but he also hit, you know, some pretty good 50-50 balls. And you think about the one that Mosley caught, put it in a spot where only his receiver could catch it. You know, the couple of the passes to Hayward were also like that. And he threw an absolute dime to Jaden Reed. I think it was the setup, Walker's third touchdown, you know, deep near the front pylon. On the south end zone. So, I mean, there were plays that Thorne made, and there were also plays that he left. He said that afterwards. So I think that, but to me, the ability to evade the pass rush, you know, that to me was something that I think is going to be critical, because if there are holes in that offensive line as we move forward and see some different competition and better opponents for Michigan State, that's going to be critical. You're going to need a quarterback that can create things and stretch and the vision to instead of turning getting a sack, turning it into a no gain or a 2 yard gain.
Speaking of moving forward, let's look ahead to this Saturday's game against Youngstown State. That'll be a noon start. Hooray at Spartan Stadium. What do you guys look for in that game? What do you think Michigan needs to work on? What is going to be satisfactory for you in terms of you see what you need to see from Michigan State to make the natural steps forward to making this a successful season?
For me, it's the same discipline and urgency and organization that they had last week. And if they play with that, they'll win this game handily, I think. And, you know, it's hard to get a read on Youngstown. They're not the program that they were when Chris was a youth. But the
That is true. That is absolutely true.
And the other thing that's going to happen to 1AA programs or FCS programs now that's going to be rough is that with the one-time transfer rule, what the advantage they used to have is you'd occasionally run into programs with more real frontline NFL talent than like the MAC schools, because people would transfer down and not want to sit out, and you'd see some real players at that level. And so that will happen less and less for them too. I don't, you know, They're not coming off a great year right now. And they've got a lot of new pieces too. So that's something to watch. But from a Michigan State standpoint, this is really about MSU, and it's about looking. It's about being focused. It's about playing with a disciplined organization and mistake-free football. It's probably about getting some other guys some opportunities at the running back position a little bit. So I don't think you'll see the same type of numbers from Kenneth Walker. He's just not going to get the same type of touches unless the game is really unexpectedly tight. You want to get some things going, and you want to give some. They did not use a lot of guys in the secondary last week because I don't think they trust a whole lot of guys back there yet. You know, this might be a good time to, you know, get some other guys some reps there. So you want to, you know, the beauty of what happened last week is it allows you to have a feel good day if you're organized where this feels like advancement. Whereas if you lose to Northwestern, nothing really comes out of this. It's just okay, they beat a bad. So I think, you know, it's there are things to get out of it. Whether we're really able to recognize them after the game will be interesting.
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything you said, especially the snaps. I mean, that was something that right after the game that I asked Mel Tucker about was, I mean, they rotated guys on the defensive line pretty liberally and at linebacker, I think they went about four deep. Not so much on the edge. I think the real and in the secondary, I think really the only guy that got extra snaps on defense was Darius Snow flipping in and out with Michael Dowell. But you know, you saw a lot. I mean, those front five or front six, you know, with the two linebackers and I still want to call them the front seven, but really it's the front six in this, they need to be able to get more pressure. That was one thing that they didn't do against Northwestern. And this is a game where if you're Youngstown State, you don't have a Hall of Famer and future NFL player like former Slippery Rock High great Matt Hogg, who's in the Youngstown State Hall of Fame. Speaking of someone that I knew growing up at one of our nearby schools who ended up going on to play at Youngstown State as the Penguins' glory years in the 90s. That's about the Youngstown State knowledge I'll flex there. But this is really one of those games that you got to get the snaps there. You got to get the snaps at receiver because there wasn't many guys at receiver getting a lot of extra snaps too. I think Terry Lockett had one catch or had one target, and you know that was the only guy outside of the starters. So you want to get the Montori Fosters and Christian Fitzpatrick's and Keon Coleman's in that game on the offensive side as well to kind of like you said build off that rhythm. I mean this is a rhythm building game more than anything. You want to head to Miami a week later having that upswing and that vibe still going and that buzz growing.
I'll be curious to see what Miami does this week. I think we mentioned last week that, you know, if they got blown out by Bama, that might completely wreck their season. And we saw that first part happen. Now we'll be interested to see how Miami reacts after that.
They've got a game against Appalachian State that's no picnic. I mean, and we've seen App State. Yeah. I mean, everybody thinks about the Michigan game, but App State's been a good program at the FBS level now for a while and competed with decent teams. And you know, Miami is, you know, we talked about the idea that you can get demoralized by a measuring stick game that goes poorly. And, you know, I think the character of Miami will be the metal of them, so to speak, will be tested. And what that means by the time MSU rolls in there, you know, I don't know.
Graham, I already believe that you picked Appalachian State to win that game on Twitter. Do I remember seeing that?
I did say that. I mean, it was sort of tongue in cheek, me saying after they lose. I mean, I don't actually. I know Appalachian State's supposed to be good this year. I saw Vegas had the over under 9 wins, but I do not know a lot of their details. So,
I'd be remiss. We talked about guys getting snaps, and this game in particular. We were in practice or going in for interviews on Wednesday after they finished practice, and I saw Harold Joyner coming out in pads from the workout. So take that for what it's worth. You know, usually guys that are in a significant injury protocol aren't coming off with their pads on. So, you know, he seems like he might be a go for this weekend. And that was, you know, he and Jalen Hunt were the two guys coming out of that Northwestern game that if you're Michigan State, you had some injury concern about. And, you know, again, another take it for what it's worth moment. Michigan State had Jalen Hunt featured going in into practice one day in pads. So, you know, it seems like whether or not they're 100% healthy, they may be football healthy.
And if you know, some of the other running backs, you want those guys to, you know, Tucker had a comment the other day about the more guys you play, the more guys that have roles on the team, the better it is, the more guys are involved. And running back is a tough position, especially if you have a guy who emerges, who separates himself from the others. It's a tough position in competitive games to give a lot of carries to a lot of guys. It just is. And I know they talked about, you know, a lot of guys, but offensive coordinators tell you two guys is about the maximum. And that's what we really saw to do it well, to feel. And so I think these are also opportunities to have guys feel a part of it. If you don't get any carries against Youngstown, that can be, you know, I don't know. That's a tough deal.
Well, you mentioned that, and I think there's two guys in particular that I think bear talking about, and that's Elisha Collins at running back and Noah Harvey at linebacker. I mean, neither of those guys saw much work at their normal position. They were on special teams. I think Harvey's only tackle came on the last play of the game at linebacker. He was the fifth linebacker in. Michigan State went through three running backs, and not one of them was Elijah Collins. They went Walker, Jordan Simmons, and then Joyner. You know, for those kind of guys, you need, that's exactly what you mentioned. You've got to keep them involved because they're veteran presence and they're strong leaders for that team. You don't want to risk losing them.
Yeah, and you mentioned Simmons. He had the touchdown in the game against Northwestern. So that's got to be a positive boost for him in terms of you guys talking about, you know, getting people involved and making sure they're part of the thing and staying happy.
Well, I think Simmons is number two. Like, I think Simmons
is number two. Yeah.
And I think he's, you know, I think his role is pretty solidified, and you're going to see him all year. Even if the carries, the one thing I would say is to caution people is however the carries are dispersed against Youngstown, don't read too much into where the pecking order is next week, because you could get a game if Michigan State gets ahead by three scores and, you know, somebody in the third quarter is getting a little bit of a hot hand and a mismatch, they might get 7-8 carries, and all of a sudden it looks like, oh, is that person, you know, I think, you know, right now I think it's pretty clearly Kenneth Walker and then Jordan Simmons, and I don't think, you know, I doubt much happens this week that changes that.
The Harvey situation to me is fascinating because, I mean, here's a guy that started last year, and really, I think, you know, you think he's the leading returning tackler. So you can clearly see that there's a shift away from that big thumping 4-3 linebacker that he is to something more of an athletic hybrid. I mean, that's where Cal Halliday comes into play. I mean, it's where Quaris Crouch comes into play. Even Chase Klein. I mean, Chase Klein kind of leaping Harvey to me was equally as surprising as everything else that I saw.
They start to have their imprint on the guys they want. And Halliday is fun to watch, by the way. He's a really he doesn't wear anything on him, which looks funny out there. He looks like I did in like seventh grade football. You know, it's like, where are your, you know, arm pads or gloves or anything? You know, he's just out there in his pads, and we'll see how long that lasts as he gets bumped around. But
he is a classic kind of guy over the years that would have gone to Youngstown State. Yeah. Quite honestly, I mean, he was an overlooked recruit in central Pennsylvania, you know, and you know, wasn't getting a lot of high major offers. He just happened to have a teammate who was one of the top receivers in the country that Ohio State picked up. So he got more eyeballs on him. And that's, I think, how Mark D'Antonio and his staff identified him. I mean, his high school coach hard sold him to a lot of major programs saying this kid can do it. This kid can do it. And but that's you know, typically that's where a 1AA program can thrive in historically, is getting those off the radar kids from those rural schools that don't necessarily have the kind of prominence as some in more urban areas. And, you know, sure enough, you know, the Michigan State unearthed him. So we can talk about the D'Antonio recruiting down the stretch, but it'll be interesting to see how many of those guys like him, like Cal Halliday, like Jordan Simmons. You know, those guys are going to be here for a while, and they're still within the footprint of what Mel Tucker wants to do.
It's pretty interesting that we have talked a lot about, you know, building squad depth and maybe seeing some of the backups play a lot Saturday. And this is a team that only won two games last year and looked pretty bad at times. I don't know if we're taking too much of a leap of faith here and all this stuff or getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but
I think a couple things. One, it was a weird year. It was a weird year for everybody.
Yeah.
Look at what Northern Illinois just did with Rocky Lombardi this past week. Yeah. Northern Illinois was a bad football team last year. I think 0-6. And nobody has been more consistent in that league going back to, you know, the Michael Turner, PJ Fleck days when they beat Alabama, Maryland, and Iowa State in the same season and being a physical football team. And Lombardi fits who they are, right? You have to give programs sort of passes for last year. Now, Michigan State, obviously, you know, had the win over Michigan and Northwestern, but it was a roster that hadn't been turned over. It was not a lot of time to prepare. It was a weird year that was played for the sake of money. I just don't think there's – I think it's – as we look at even opponents that Michigan State plays, what did they do last year? And that includes Youngstown. It is – I mean, it's Youngstown played in the spring. You know, like it's weird. You got to be careful judging what happened last year and equating it to what to expect now.
Yeah. I mean, I mostly agree with you guys. I was just I just wanted to throw a little caution to the wind out there in case we suddenly find ourselves watching a close game on Saturday that I don't think any of us expect.
It's happened before against Youngstown State.
Yeah. Yeah.
With 2012. What year was that that people were a little panicky? I think it was like a 28-7 win. Yeah.
They just didn't look strong. You know, they had a few years even when they were rolling where they did not look great in openers, and they just gotten off to sluggish starts, and I think Youngstown was one of those. It was like Youngstown and Jacksonville were the 2 years back to back, the 1AA's or whatever that they were. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And by the way, do you have your Phil? Do you have your NIU Rocky Lombardi jersey yet?
I ordered it on Sunday afternoon after I saw that touchdown pass.
Okay.
It was actually the 2011 year. By the way,
What's that?
The 2011 year, not 2012.
Okay. But yeah, but that was still a great team, and they struggled out of the gate in that game, you know. So that, I mean, that tells you, yeah, and absolutely. I mean, this, again, we don't know what Youngstown is, but you know, MSU is not in a place where they can walk over anybody or have a sleepy day. And the one thing that's going to help in terms of this game, like this is one of the problems with the Big Ten openers, and if they keep doing these over the years, and I think the Big Ten opener is going to go away as the ACC Pac-12 alliance happens because it's just hard to maneuver things, but. This is the problem with it if you have a home opener. If this game had not been at Northwestern last week, if they had played a Big Ten home opener, so it wasn't new for the crowd, it wasn't new for anybody, the environment wasn't new, and then you play Youngstown, the sleepy, there's a real chance of having that sort of thing happen to you. The fact that this is the first game really in front of fans at Spartan Stadium in almost 2 years at this point, I think will take the energy in the stadium will get rid of any likelihood that this will be a sleepy atmosphere and a sluggish start.
Yeah, it's hard to remember that there was an original schedule for a year ago that had them opening at home with Northwestern.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was the plan for 2020, and then, you know, we know what happened, and you know, this schedule, I think, for them right now bodes pretty well because you know, we'll see what happens this week, but then your trip to Miami can be a real statement kind of game. And then Nebraska, we've seen, has kind of fallen on hard times. So, you know, if you're able to get out of Coral Gables with a win, you got a chance to start 4-0. And, you know, that's something that, you know, you talk about the buzz right now. You get to that point and you can come out of that game 4-0. Now you start to reassess expectations of this program and this team. Because, again, none of us knew exactly what to expect coming into this. There's no comparative. Name me a comparative where you've turned over half a roster in the history of college football.
What will get fascinating, Chris, is if what you just alluded to works. Like, say the season keeps going swimmingly and they stay fairly healthy. And even if some things go wrong late, say they wind up with 7 or 8 wins and they get to a place that nobody really expected, and they do, and the roster is full of a few guys who were transfers who are getting all conference consideration and that sort of stuff. You're going to see other programs try to do this. Now, it is hard. It takes again, this is what made Mark D'Antonio so good, the idea of identifying guys early on. This is what Tucker and I said. You have to identify the right guys and then recruit them, because there are lots of guys in the transfer portal you probably don't want on your roster who aren't going to help you a lot. And so this will not be something just because people say they're going to duplicate it, but there will be others who will try, and that will get, and there will be others who are good at it, and so you'll see more of it.
That's why I asked Pat Fitzgerald last week before the game. I said, you know, do you see this being kind of a cautionary tale or an advisory tale for people? You know, coaches, he said it great. He's like, coaches are the great plagiarists. You know, if it works, they're going to steal it. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that a lot of coaches are watching this. And a lot of coaches, even a guy going back to Youngstown State, a guy like Bo Pelini, who's out of a job right now, who might come back in at another school, he's watching this, because if this works for a first-year coach in particular at a new program, this is a great way to get the pieces in place that you want. And you know, listen, Kenneth Walker is – you can go out and you know, 3 years ago you would be recruiting a high school kid who was probably what, maybe a two-star kid? I mean, you think about those early D'Antonio classes when he took over. You know, you're getting 2-3-star kids late in that recruiting cycle if you're hired in December, January at a new program. Kenneth Walker's a 5-star transfer. As good as Harold Joyner was in the recruiting realm, I think he was a 5-star kid and one of the best. Kenneth Walker is a 5-star transfer from a Power 5 program. I mean, he may not have been in high school, but you've got evidence. Yeah. Of what he could do at the highest level. And that's what I think is different. It's a, you know, it's fascinating to see, you know, how Tucker went about it, but I think it's also going to be fascinating to see how others around the country react to what's going on here.
And there are a lot of important things that have taken place, I think, for recruits, and people are watching. And I'm to talk about two of them. One is the Kenneth Walker situation, where you have a transfer that comes in and becomes the guy. And I know Elijah Collins had the rough year last year after COVID and all that stuff, but was a guy who had established himself as a pretty promising player 2 years ago and is sort of, you know, overtaken. But on the same token, you get a guy like Peyton Thorne who holds off the transfer that they bring in. And what that speaks to, and I think this is really important for chemistry and other things, that they're going to play the best guys. There are no guarantees if you transfer in. And if you're one of the players who are in the program and they bring somebody in, they're not just going to give them the job. And I think those developments are probably, you know, looking at it now, really, you know, important. It's not that they wouldn't have given Anthony Russo the job if he had been the better quarterback, but how that played out, I'm not sure doesn't really work out for them in terms of locker room and not feeling like you just brought in replacements.
Well, you know who quietly has really emerged in one of those position battles as really stellar guys is Michael Dowell and I think Darius Snow. Yeah. I mean, the fact that they're sharing that position, they're two guys that were here and that were part of previous recruiting classes, and they over-recruited that position to bring in Chester Kimbrough, they bring in Marquis Lowry, they bring in Kari Crump, and those two guys held that off. And Kalen Gervin on the edge as well. I mean, those are internal guys. I mean, so I think that's a message to the team as well, that you know, you can say the best guys are going to play, but it's a whole other thing after you go through transfers and bring them in. And, you know, that's, I think, critical. You know, you're sending a message to your team that, no, this is legitimately how it's going. We want to be as good as we can. Yeah. And I think that's where Tucker gets the buy-in from these guys, because I think as much as I think Mark D'Antonio did early in his tenure to create that kind of buy-in, I think the message towards the end kind of got a little muted, because he's been here for almost 15 years. And guys, you know how it is. I mean, at some point you tune people out, kind of probably about at the 52-minute mark of this podcast, you're tuning me out. But the
I would would never do that, Chris.
No. But you know what I mean? It's like the fresh voice and the all the things that we've heard in repetitive nature from Tucker are fresh to those guys, and they're living it and they're buying into it. You know, particularly the guys that were here during the D'Antonio era.
And I got to say, if I were a kid who'd been through two coaches and just having covered several coaches in different sports over the years, you would start to hear, I think if I was like a fifth year senior and I started to hear some of the way coaches speak, I would have trouble not buying in, but I would just go up to the coach quietly and say, I don't need to hear it, because I've sort of heard, you know, like I've heard every coach say this, and I don't need this. And this is not, I get it. It's a line and whatever it is, you know, like, I don't know, like if PJ Fleck had used the word elite to me that many times, I could have taken it without laughing.
I'll tell you, you're 100% right. And I think one thing I think D'Antonio doesn't get enough credit for is I think he changed things up quite a bit. I mean, he was really good with changing his message and changing some of the things that he would say over time. You know, you think about all the quote unquote mantras that he would come up with and, you know, the motivational things and whatever tactics they could be. You know, I thought he always did a pretty good job of that. And then, you know, towards the end, it was kind of hitting on the same ground. It was like, it's like chase it and then chase it again or chase it farther or something. You know, there were things that you just kind of run out in the well at some point because, you know, you're dipping into the motivational tactics over and over again. And there's only so much you can do to motivate guys.
Chase it for real this time.
P4RBAG.
To put a wrap on the transfer stuff, if I got this correct, four transfers are starters and Walker, Horst, Williams, and Crouch. Am I missing anybody or is that the four?
Sounds right.
As we alluded to at the very beginning of this podcast, Michigan State Athletics signed into a pretty interesting and lucrative, perhaps, name, image, and likeness deal with United Wholesale Mortgage, which is run by a former Michigan State basketball walk-on, Matt Ishbia. Graham, I know you wrote about him yesterday, or which would have been Wednesday, and then Chris, I know you've written about him previously and everything with that. So it's a thing where all Michigan State men's basketball and football players will get a $500 a month stipend, and that's cool for those two teams, but it also kind of set off a little bit of a backlash because there were no women's teams involved or any of the other non-revenue sports involved in this deal. Graham, what was kind of your reaction to all of this on the whole?
Yeah, a couple things. One, I mean, I think it's important for MSU because, you know, there are questions. Is a school like Michigan State and East Lansing going to fall behind in the name, image, and likeness game for its athletes? And this is clearly, I mean, they may get surpassed at some point and other teams, but this allows them to sort of work from the front a little bit. And I think that's important. This is also something that's just covers the whole team. There's not any, you know, hurt feelings that one guy's making a lot and another guy's not. Everybody's making the same. And it's something that aids two sports that frankly often do come from, they're more kids probably from lesser backgrounds, but also these are the revenue sports. And this is what name, image, and likeness is. When it comes to I did see a couple state reps upset about the not having women's sports, and there was some other reaction from that. I think
there's some swimming and diving folks that have kind of chimed in as well.
Yeah, and I think most athletes aren't outraged. I think they understand the economic model. They understand a healthy football and basketball makes sense. And the difference is, between about if he was to do every sport, it'd be about $5 million a year. This is about $800,000, and so you're asking somebody who's, it's their money and their decision to spend an extra $4.2 million, where there may not be value. Because you have to remember, this is an endorsement. There has to be value for the company, and I don't know that is sometimes lost. This isn't an equity deal. Like, this isn't like Title IX. This isn't like something that happens within the school where there should be gender equity. This is separate. This is what people wanted, to go into a more professional model where there are going to be hurt feelings. And and it's not to say that there aren't women athletes who have more Instagram followers and are non-rev athletes who would be better. And this is more, you know, would be better for Matt Ishbia's company. It's not to say he has this right. And he did say they're going to continue, you know, walk before they run and continue to look at this. I just think that's an important thing. People sort of, you know, people feel like it's earned, it's deserved that everybody gets something. That's not the way this is going to be with name, image, and likeness. And certainly, like, where do you go? Like, people say, well, the women have a basketball team. Well, if you were just to go to the next closest almost revenue sport, that would be hockey. And why would you go women's basketball or women's volleyball? I mean, I think that's a, I mean, you know, and this isn't, this isn't just about revenue, because I mean, the women's basketball team loses like $4 million a year, which is, you know, but that has nothing to do with this. This is about what they can do for Matt Ishbia's company, but it's also about what Matt Ishbia, what's important to Matt Ishbia, which is these two teams, which clearly, and which is most important to most fans. And look, it would be great if everybody got that. And I would love to see that, but it's not my place to tell somebody else how to spend $4.2 million for their company, nor is it anybody's place. This is a different deal than what happens within the university.
You cannot legislate private business in this. And that's ultimately, it's private business between the athletes and the business owners. I mean, that's ultimately how the current construct of what name, image, likeness is. And, you know, if a women's tennis player is an elite women's tennis player at the college level and wants to go out, and whether it affect, that's the other thing that I'm still curious about, someone like a James Pyatt, you know, it might not affect him from a collegiate standpoint to go out and get a big name, image, likeness deal, but how does it affect his standing with the PGA Tour as an amateur? You know, there are some things that you're going to be able to do that for the governing bodies. So that's going to be fascinating to kind of watch too. Unintended consequences, as someone has said about a lot of this stuff over the past few years. But I think that, you know, there are going to be opportunities for other teams. I mean, I think it's, you know, of course the more visible ones are going to be the more visible sports, because that's how marketing works. There's a reason that the NFL gets more and the PGA golfers sometimes get more than the LPGA golfers, although some LPGA golfers get more. Same with the ATP and the WTA. And those are the two biggest comparatives in terms of women's sports. But if you look at something along the lines of soccer, I mean, you've seen the U.S. team has fought for similar wages to the men's team, the men's national team. But that's at the national scope. But you aren't going to be able to argue that on the private business scope when it comes to the women's soccer leagues, the professional women's soccer leagues versus the MLS, which will pay higher salaries. I mean, it's, you know, this is something that there is no blueprint for, but yet there is something comparative at the professional level, but it is outside of the jurisdiction. It should be outside of the jurisdiction of the schools. I don't know how, this is kind of the wonkiness of where we're at in the wild west of NIL days. And, you know, maybe something like this won't be allowed in the future, but Michigan State's taking advantage of it now while it is legal.
Yeah, a couple of things are interesting. One is the fact that it's Michigan State men's basketball and football. I mean, which makes it, I believe, the largest to this point blanket NIL deal. Because Miami, Florida, you know, they play Miami in a couple of weeks. Miami has something similar for their football program.
Yep.
What's interesting about MSU is that MSU is more than most places a balanced school in terms of fan passion, right? Football, basketball. What you don't see, I mean, like Michigan State does not have what Indiana or Kentucky has in terms of basketball. They don't have what Notre Dame or Ohio State have in terms of football. But in terms of combined, they have probably a better balance than almost anybody. And what was interesting is I always wondered if that would hurt them in name, image, and likeness, and it still might at some point, that you didn't have – were you better off with one of your programs for some of those athletes just having this fever pitch that was, you know, like Kentucky basketball. But in this case – you see the blank, you know, you see both programs valued and seen equally by Matt Ishbia. And that's where this is different than the pros. In the pros, it truly is all about what can this athlete do for our business largely. The difference in college, though, is you are getting boosters and people who care about the university, care about the teams, want the teams to succeed, want the recruiting element to be important. And that's something Ishbia said yesterday. And so I do think that is different than the pros. But what he cares about the recruiting, it isn't how MSU volleyball recruits. That's not, he cares about MSU football and basketball and how they're able to use it. And now, again, he said they're probably not done. I just think one of the things also is, and I've heard this from a number of, covering a lot of men's and women's college sports for 16 years now, one of the things I've heard that has not always helped women's sports is this notion of, I've heard meetings that sort of begin with, well, what do the men have? Instead of what is best for us. And I've seen that in terms of facilities or where a tournament is played or all sorts of things that don't lead to the best decision. Like right now, the conversation should be, well, how do we find opportunities or what's out there that we can do for the women's sports and to find something similar or something that, along these lines that helps certain sports. I think that's the argument, not, wait a sec, Matt Ishbia, you need to do this too.
Yeah. I mean, what business is going to make that next step for their business to say, you know what, we're going to give the biggest name, image, likeness deal to Michigan State women's athletes. That's what has to be done. I mean, quite honestly, when you're talking about the private business sector like this, I mean, you know, could it be, you know, something like the running company running the shoe place in Okemos? I mean, that would be a big statement. I mean, you get the men's and women's cross country teams on board, or, you know, any number of the women's basketball team could be sponsored by, you know, a moving company that's based in East Lansing, something along those lines. You know, I mean, I think what to me is fascinating, though, and this tells you how crazy this scenario and environment is and how much things have changed in the past year. You are going to be in November 9th when Michigan State takes on Kansas. You're going to have potentially starter Malik Hall, sponsored by United Wholesale Mortgage, playing for the Michigan State Spartans, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
It's incredible. The two competing mortgage companies who are both run by billionaire alums is just perfect for MSU. I mean, it is ideal. Yeah. I'm not saying these guys wouldn't give money if they weren't, but they both – want to one up the other one. There's no question about it. And that is, it's worked out to MSU's favor incredibly. Yeah.
I will mention one company that has branched out to numerous athletes in various areas. That's Lansing Local, and that's Moneyball. And then they've got a handful of athletes that they are sponsoring, including Nia Cloudon on the Michigan State women's basketball team. So
I think there's going to be a lot of those smaller local businesses that really kind of latch into these NIL deals with kids that have prominence within their sphere. I mean, right? I mean, this is, you know, a guy like Elijah Collins is with Moneyball, and
so is Keon Coleman.
Keon Coleman. I mean, you know, but those are names right now that are very, very well known within the footprint of Michigan State, you know, in the draw 5-10 mile circle
and
that radius.
You know, golfers and tennis play, you know, generally from certain sports, kids come from money. Hockey players tend to come from money. And I'm not saying that kids can't use it, because the one thing about being a Division I athlete is there's very little time to work on campus, to have a job separately. And I have often thought that it would be great if their practice time was treated almost like a work study, and there was a stipend for that was a little more. But I think, you know, there are kids like Xavier Henderson. Great example of Big Ten Media Days. I was asking him about NIL, and he's like, well, I'm well off. I've always been well off. It doesn't really matter to me. There are going to be kids this doesn't make a difference to. And I think the older kids, especially, I was talking to a couple of people that same day in other schools that talked about, when you get this, especially in football, when you're 4 months from like your pro opportunities, you don't have a lot of time to mess with this. You know, the Mumfords, the offensive lineman from Ohio State, is a
Thayer Munford.
Yeah, he does not. He was basically talking about, he does not have time to be signing autographs. His job is his craft and being in the best place he can be next NFL draft. And I think a guy like Xavier Henderson viewed it the same way. He, you know, obviously this is something that was offered to all of them, and they'll do. I do not see certain players going out and taking a lot of extra time. Whereas if you're a younger guy or you come from very modest means or less, this could be something that's very important to you.
And that's something that we talked to Tom Izzo this summer about. You know, yeah. He did a pretty good breakdown for a bunch of numbskulls like us. And, you know, one of the things that was fascinating was the amount of money that these guys get for their rookie card deals for trading cards.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're a first-round pick, you get a good amount of money. Does that time and effort you spend on your game put into the back end – is that more beneficial for you financially than the front end of getting, you know, $3,000 or whatever for tweeting? You know, I mean, if you're on your phone, you're not working on your games. It's going to be an interesting balancing act for a lot of guys. But I think that, you know, you mentioned about Xavier Henderson. I think of a different Xavier and Tillman, of how circumstances also can make this important, impactful. I mean, you know, Tillman signs with Michigan State, and, you know, and he looks like he's going to be, you know, grow into a 4-year player. And then he has a child. And, you know, he gets married and he has another child. So that's I think another thing that, listen, life happens, and it doesn't matter if you're in college or not. You know, there's no difference between a guy in Grand Rapids that at 18 years old goes to work for the city in the sanitation department versus Xavier Tillman, who goes to Michigan State to play basketball and work on his degree. And life happens. And, you know, when that happens to those kids, they have to be able to have an opportunity to earn. They cannot be squelched in that responsibility and in their life. And, you know, I think there are definite benefits to these kids for a lot of reasons. It's going to be it's the details, the ironing out of making it so it's not strictly pay for play. Cause I know a lot of people are wondering about that with this deal and with all these blanket deals. So,
you know, to that point, yeah, I think where the best decisions are going to be made are kids who don't feel pressure necessarily to leave ahead of maybe when they shouldn't. You know, it may save some kids from the G League who can now turn a decent, you know, okay, I can put in another year at this university and try to take another crack at the NBA, because I'm going to be making this. I can go overseas eventually and make my money, but I can also get my degree in football, you know, where your grade is a seventh-round pick and your family is at home and needs help. And you're able to do enough where you don't feel that guilt and pressure, you know, and do another year to see if you can be in a better spot. So I think it's a totally good thing. And you know, and there will be opportunities. This is the blanket thing makes this a little different, but because really, if you look at, like, Kenneth Walker is MSU's first star of the Mel Tucker era, the first guy, and obviously that's one game, but, you know, right now would be the most appeal. You're going to see that in other sports. I'll be interested to see what Pyatt gets in golf. I'll be interested to see what, you know, if there's a women's basketball standout who becomes, you know, a big deal player. What would Ariel Powers, you know, if she would have had some opportunities, or Tori Jankowska in years, or you get local kids. There are going to be opportunities. I think the blanket nature of it, as Chris alluded to, the idea that this is just pay for play and then why not more. But again, it still falls under the idea that this is an endorsement and it's a private business. And you, as Chris said, you can't tell them what to do with their money.
All right. Well, let's move on to our final segment of every podcast, and that is predictions. I did find it interesting that, well, I had not looked at the spread since Tuesday, but I believe Michigan State was only a, quote unquote, only a 20-point favorite over Youngstown State. And that's my initial reaction. That seems a little low based on what they did against Northwestern, but that could be a moneymaker for people betting on Michigan State, or it is a classic trap game for the Spartans. Graham, or Chris, I'll have you go first, actually. What are you thinking about the score and who wins?
Well, I think I'm going to hold with what I had going into the season of 48-7. You know, I thought the defense against Northwestern, even within its shaky moments, you know, we talked about the resilience that they have. And, you know, that was a former five-star quarterback in Hunter Johnson, who's, you know, a senior, a veteran, and he's got some weapons. You know, I think that they played pretty well. They cut the run game out from and under Northwestern for the most part. I mean, there were a couple big, I think there was one big gain that they had for 49 yards that accounted for almost nearly half of their 117 rushing yards. So, you know, I do think that Youngstown State's kind of fallen quite a bit, you know, and for a lot of reasons, I think. I'll stick with 48-7 Michigan State.
I'm around there. I think I have 41-10, and I think that could happen. It really is. I don't quite have a grasp on the level of resistance the Youngstown State's going to provide. And I do think it not being a ho-hum third game of the year, second home game, noon start, the fact that it's the first time the crowd is going to be there for MSU and their chance to try to show off and there's still, I just think there's going to be an energy to the place, even for a noon kick, that will help.
Swag surf, baby.
Yeah. I'm going to go 41-10 MSU.
All right. Good podcast, guys. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Next week is going to be interesting when we start talking Miami, particularly if Michigan State somehow loses this game. But, you know, I think that we're going to start talking about the growing buzz. I mean, we talked a little bit about it today, but, you know, that this performance this week in front of the home fans, I think, will definitely create the energy moving forward in the rest of the season.
And if they beat Miami, you
watch out.
The buzz will get real.
All right. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Greenwhite. Thanks for listening.